From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Sarah Irvin, sitting in for John Wells today.
We kick off this morning with cognitive psychologist Brian Butterworth, who takes listeners on a journey through the science of numerical processing and how humans actually compare to the animal world. It's all in his new book, Can Fish Count?
Then we will hear from world-class pediatric surgeon and social scientist and best-selling author, Dr. Dana Seskind, who takes a revelatory new look at the neuroscience of early childhood development and how it can guide us towards a future in which every child has the opportunity to fulfill their potential.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. My next guest is pioneering cognitive psychologist, Dr. Brian Butterworth. He works on the genetics and neuroscience of mathematical abilities and disabilities at University College London. He's a fellow of the British Academy. He joins me now to talk about how we process numerically and to talk about his new book, Can Fish Count? What Animals Reveal About Our Uniquely Mathematical Minds. Dr. Butterworth, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
You know, I'm very pleased to be here.
Let's talk just a bit about mathematical abilities and disabilities and how this, I mean, it ties into how we process numerically. You talk about how that is sort of a separate part of the brain. Can you explore that a little bit with us?
In humans, there are two regions that are really important for processing any kind of numerical information. And they're just above your left and right ear in the what's called the parietal lobe, and in fact in quite a small region of the parietal lobe. Now we know this from two sorts of evidence. One is if these regions get damaged, then your numerical abilities, whatever you had before the damage, will be affected. Exactly how they're affected depends on lots of different factors, in particular how your brain was processing numerical information before it was damaged. So if you had done much, then it will have a different effect than if you'd done a lot. But also it depends very specifically on how and where the damage occurs. So sometimes you could lose your ability to add, sometimes to multiply, sometimes to divide, sometimes all of those things. So that's one way. The other way is more recent, which is brain imaging. So here you look at patterns of activation. And again, it's these areas in the parietal lobes that are active when you're doing pretty well any numerical task. So we've got these types, these convergent sources of evidence for a very specialized system in the brain for doing numerical tasks.
It's interesting, and I'm hoping that education has gotten better, especially when it comes to the realm of mathematics or math, as you call it. so many people emerge from education saying, well, I just can't do math. I don't have a mathematical mind. And I have a sense that this was because, you know, at an early age, people just got turned off of it at some point. But would you argue that it's in the parietal lobe? Our mathematical mind is alive and well and functioning unless something happens to it from the outside.
Sure. If something happens to it, then your mathematical processing will be affected. I mean, the reason why a lot of people claim to be very bad at maths is because they haven't been very well taught. I mean, one of the special needs teachers that I've worked with says that the real problem is not anxiety, but fear. people are afraid that some people, maybe many people, are afraid of numbers. And that's something that they've learned. They've learned to be afraid of numbers. But I've been particularly interested in people who are not afraid of numbers for that reason, but who have something which is anomalous in their parietal lobes, which means that they actually have a lot of trouble learning arithmetic. Not other branches of mathematics, just arithmetic. And this is called dyscalculia. And it's not widely recognized, not like dyslexia. It's not that widely recognized. And because it's not recognized, of course, people haven't been as keen to identify it or as keen to find ways of helping people who suffer from dyscalculia.
Right. So that's interesting. Our dyscalculia, is it something you're born with and can it be fixed?
It's something you're born with. In some cases, it'll be inherited. Mm. In other cases, it might be due to some accident that happens to your brain. For example, fetal alcohol syndrome, where the mother is drinking too much alcohol during pregnancy, that can affect it. Or there could be something that goes wrong in the process of birth, which could affect the parietal lobes. So there are these two reasons why at birth you could be bad at numbers.
As a cognitive psychologist, how did you get interested in numbers?
So why do some people have dyscalculia? And as I said at the beginning, well, sometimes it's due to life circumstances, like, you know, the fetal alcohol syndrome. Sometimes it could be brain damage either during birth or later. But some of it's going to be hereditary. It's going to be genetic. And one of the things that we noticed, another bit of luck here, though I'd like to think my mind was properly prepared for this, is that when we were testing fish, some fish seemed to be quite good with numbers, and other fish of the same species were not very good at numbers. And so we wondered, you know, why is this particular, let's call him Freddy fish, why is Freddy fish not very good? Well, it could be he was having an off day, wasn't interested, he wasn't hungry, didn't want to do the task, whatever. So we retested Freddy, and sure enough, he still wasn't very good. And so we thought, why is Freddy not very good? And the other fish are actually quite good on this task. And one possibility is that Freddy's genes are a bit different from the other ones of the same species. So what we're doing now is we're taking actually a different species of fish called zebra fish because of their stripes, where the genome has been sequenced and where the technology now exists to create variants of that genome. So we could say, well, you know, maybe, you know, gene X isn't working terribly well. So maybe that's the problem. So we can actually test this in our fish. So this is work that's been going on for about a year or so, and invite me back in a year or two and I'll tell you what the results are. At the moment, I think we're doing quite well, but that's the basic idea. The idea is to test genes which we know are in humans and also in fish, or at least what's called their paralogs are in humans and in fish, and see, you know, maybe it's this particular gene that's causing the problem, or maybe this combination of genes that cause the problem or make some contribution to the problem. So that's why, just by a series of lucky accidents, we're now testing the genetics of dyscalculia in zebrafish.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Brian Butterworth. His new book is Can Fish Count? What Animals Reveal About Our Uniquely Mathematical Minds. If you were actually testing a task with fish versus a genetic test, what is that task?
Well, we like to do tasks that are that we think are the species that we're testing could do. And we, because actually in real life, being able to count is very useful. So in the case of our little fish, they live in shoals, and it's helpful for them to live in larger shoals rather than smaller shoals, because it reduces the risk of predation. So you've got a big predator coming at a shoal of fish that's going to eat some of them. Is it going to eat Freddy? Well, not if Freddy's in a big shoal, very likely he's going to survive. His friends might get eaten, but he won't, or unlikely to. If he's in a small shoal, then he's more likely to get eaten. So we know that fish prefer large shoals. We know this from experiments in the wild and also in the lab. So we've tested fish in the lab. We know that they can select between 8 fish over here and 6 fish over there. They can do that quite easily. We can also teach them to select a display with more abstract objects on it, so squares and circles and things. Now, that's not something that they see in real life, squares and circles, but they can learn to pick out the display with more, or indeed with fewer, of these squares and circles. So we can train them, and we can observe them doing what comes naturally. And we can also observe the ones that are actually not very good at doing this. And if I may just elaborate this story a bit, one of the things that we did with humans is we asked them to say, are there more blue dots or more yellow dots? And the two people do this. They can't see each other doing it, but they can see the result of their decision. So if A says more blue and B says more yellow, then they have a discussion and they have to come to a conclusion about whether they're more blue or more yellow. And what you find is that their joint decision is better than each of their decisions on average, or the mean of their two decisions. So we did this with humans, and we thought, of course, can we do this with fish? So this is what we did with fish, except that we going back to an earlier point, we took a good fish and a bad fish, put them in together to see whether, working together, they would do better. And they did do better. And in fact, they did as well as the better fish. So if another fish, let's call him Frobisher fish, is very good on numbers, and Freddy fish is not very good on numbers, Freddy will follow Frobisher over to the correct side of the tank, the side with more other little fish in it. And we had our paper on this was called Meritocratic Leadership in Guppies. This wasn't with zebrafish, this was with guppies. And this actually is quite interesting, because in the case of fish, it might well be that shoals choose to go where, if you like, the better fish and the quicker fish making the quicker decision decides to go. Oh. So it's, I thought, ecologically quite an interesting result. I'm waiting to see some large-scale studies along those lines.
Well, and it ends up really having a huge effect on their survival and how much they are able to reproduce and flourish in the wild, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other animals? I mean, we know you mentioned how bees and ants and, you know, many other animals that you've observed and provided tasks for, I'm sure, have either numerical acumen or not. What's been your favorite experiment that you've done with animals to see about their numerical abilities?
I'm not really an animal experimenter. I kind of leave this to other people, apart from fish, okay?
You love those fish.
I only work with humans and fish. But there are, I mean, some of my friends do some wonderful experiments. There's a colleague of mine in London called Lars Chitka, who's just bringing out a wonderful book called The Mind of the Bee. He's a great bee expert. And one of the things that he discovered was that bees count landmarks. So bees have to know how far they've gone from the hive in order to figure out how they have to get back to the hive. So how do they do that? Well, they have various different ways of doing it, but one of the ways is by counting the landmarks that they encounter between the hive and the food source. Then they can kind of work out how they're going to get back.
So trees, fence posts, rocks.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Lars used large yellow tents so he could control the distance between the tents, so he could tell whether the bee is locating the food source at a particular distance or a particular number of big yellow tents from the hive. And actually, ants do the same. They can also count landmarks. Perhaps even more extraordinary than that is they can count their own steps. So this isn't all ants. These are ants that live in a desert with high winds in North Africa. Now, ants, as you may know, leave a chemical trail. So when they go off and find some food and they have to bring it back to the nest, they can follow this trail. But if you can't leave a chemical trail because it's very hot and very windy and the chemical trail will disappear within seconds, then you have to find another way of doing it. And the way these particular desert ants do it is they count the number of steps that they make between the nest and the food source. And if you modify the length of their legs after they've reached the food source, either by lengthening them or shortening them, then they're going to get their return journey wrong. If you shorten them, they're going to end up looking somewhere before the nest. And if you lengthen them, then they're going to start looking for somewhere beyond where the nest was. And you can tell that they're doing the counting. And you can do this in the laboratory with something like a 10-meter distance between the nest and the food source. And, that's 770 steps between, 10 meters, something like 770, 800. And you know that it's the number of steps that's really critical. So these tiny brains, 250,000 neurons, we've got 85 billion, by the way, that's enough to do the counting. And in fact, one of the themes of the book is actually the counting mechanisms that these little creatures have, and that we have as well, is really a very simple mechanism. Counting is a really simple mechanism. Deciding what to count, that's the difficult bit. And so I don't know that these ants can count anything other than the number of steps, but of course we can count anything. We can count 3 coins in the fountain as physical objects. We can count, say, 3 chimes of Big Ben, that sound. Mm-hmm. Or we can count 3 wishes, and those are abstract objects. Mm-hmm. And so one of the themes of the book is that actually counting is very simple, and it's actually important for lots of different reasons for animals to be able to do it. And the degree to which they can abstract from what they're counting, that is deciding what things that they can count, that's the tricky bit. And of course, even bees can do it to some extent, because they can count these landmarks or those landmarks. They're not the same landmarks. So there is some degree of abstraction or generalization there. So they're pretty clever. As Darwin noted, he thought that the ant brain was one of the most marvelous things in the universe, because this tiny, tiny amount of what he called nervous matter could do all these different things. And he was right. It is a marvelous little device, the ant brain.
Absolutely. Okay, I just have to ask this burning question about how you shorten or lengthen an ant's step or legs. I can imagine how you shorten. I don't know how you lengthen.
Well, you're probably right about how you shorten it. You just have to chop it off. So ant lovers, look away here. To lengthen it, what you do is you put a bit of bristle or hair on the end of the leg. Wow. So that it's like a stilt. So if you imagine that the ant walking on stilts, so that's how you lengthen it. And you can predict by the amount that you change the ant's leg length, how far they're going to be wrong about getting back to the nest.
That's fascinating.
That's not my research. That's somebody else's research. But I think it's just a wonderful piece of science.
Well, so in your book, Can Fish Count? You've taken this research that others have done on animals, and sort of applied them to humans. And it makes me think about when you were talking about the ant and even a bee and being able to recognize landmarks and things like that, to be able to know direction. It makes me think that somehow with our, with technology and how we all use a GPS instead of our own sort of internal compass, how maybe our parietal lobes may be shrinking in some ways. I feel like we are losing a certain portion of our ability and our brains when we don't exercise them in a way. And I'm just kind of curious about that.
That's an interesting speculation. I don't know any research that bears on it. But one thing that does... it does spark one thought of mine, which is that, of course, a lot of animals migrate, either a greater or lesser distance. So, for example, the bar-tailed godwit, a small bird, flies from Alaska to New Zealand every year, 29,000 kilometers, and then back again, right? That's quite a long trip, okay?
Mm-hmm.
How does it do it? So my suggestion in the book is it's got something like Google Maps in its head, so which gives you direction and distance, and it's all numbers, right? Google Maps is just numbers, ultimately zeros and ones. You look down into the computer, it's just zeros and ones, and a direction is some kind of computation over those zeros and ones. I'll tell you, and of course, in Google Maps, it can tell you where you can stop for food or get more gas, right? And mm-hmm. maybe that's also in the bird's head. But the bird is actually better, has a system that's better than Google Maps, because one of the things it has to think about is how high to fly. So it's got to be a map in three dimensions, because it's got to find, you know, the optimal wind direction and speed in order to get to its destination. So it's going to have something like a three-dimensional map. Maybe it doesn't have to have a map of everywhere, just a map of its route, and maybe it doesn't have to have all the detail, maybe it just has to have some of the detail. So it's a bit like having a Google map in your head, but in three dimensions.
That's great. I'm curious about how this research is being applied to those with dyscalculia, and also how pervasive dyscalculia is. What percentage of the population has it?
Both good questions. Our best estimate at the moment is a prevalence of about 5%. There have been some quite large-scale studies that we've done in Australia and in Cuba, and we come up with rather similar figures. Other people have used slightly different methods and come up with around 5% of the population. So when you think about what 5% of the US population is, something I can't work out in my head, that's millions of people.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And they don't know why they're no good at it either. That's the real problem, is they just think they're stupid. Why can't I do what everybody else in the class can do? Why do I have struggle remembering my pen? You know, why is it I can't tell you, you know, what percentage I should leave the waiter, and so on. So about 5% seems to be the answer. And can these people be helped? Yes, they can. Whether they can be cured is another matter. It's a bit like, in that sense, it's a bit like dyslexia. You can get dyslexics to be pretty good readers. No matter, some of the dyslexics, I mean, I used to work in dyslexia. Some of the dyslexics I tested are really good readers. You know, on any standardized reading test, they're pretty good. But they don't read in the same way that I read. They read differently. But they found a way of reading effectively. Now, what people have been doing, not me particularly, but what people have been doing is finding ways to help dyscalculics overcome everyday problems. They can improve their arithmetic as well, but, you know, they're not going to be doing it in the same way that you or I do it.
Mm-hmm.
What's really needed is a way of doing a long-term exploration of what works to really help dyscalculics and what doesn't. And it's very hard to get long-term funding. It's very hard to get long-term commitment to a long-term project. You know, you have to look at a kid that you diagnose at 5. What's this kid like at 10? What's the kid like as an adult? I mean, that's a long-term project. What we're doing now is we're developing digital games specifically designed to help dyscalculics. So we've got a big project here in Buenos Aires, which we hope to spread to the whole of Latin America and parts of Europe as well, where they speak Spanish, Portuguese. But also, because it's digital, we can make it available with other languages as well.
Well, it's just fascinating work. And I completely lost track of time because I was so interested in this topic. I've got to let you go. But I wanted to just mention one thing, like all of the work that we have done around dyslexia, yeah. It has really destigmatized those who have dyslexia and really help them find workarounds. And like you say, turn them into very good readers in many cases. And I think the work that you're doing on dyscalculia is also that. It's very important work. And it's a world that I think a lot of us don't know much about. So I'm so thankful that you could join me.
Right. What we need is some very high profile dyscalculics who could lead this project. So lots of very high-profile dyslexics. I know one or two high-profile dyscalculics, but we'd like more. So if any of you, you know, famous footballers, famous film stars, rock stars, who are listening to this and are dyscalculic or think they might be dyscalculic, we're always happy to test you, please get in touch and you can help us make the world more aware of this actually very serious problem for many people.
Absolutely. Well, the book is Can Fish Count? What Animals Reveal About Our Uniquely Mathematical Minds. My guest, Dr. Brian Butterworth, who joins me from Buenos Aires. Brian, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Lynn.
You're listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Sarah Irvin, my fill-in guest co-host who's sitting in for John Wells. And thank you, Sarah.
Good morning, Lynn.
Great to have you here. Well, neuroscience shows us 85% of human brain development occurs in the first 5 years of life. And our next guest, Dr. Dana Suskind, says we must make healthy brain development really our North Star, our organizing principle around which our entire society is oriented. And we must do so by elevating our expectations for how society supports parents, the first and most important architects of children's brains. Dr. Suskind's new book is Parent Nation, Unlocking Every Child's Potential, Fulfilling Society's Promise. Dana Suskind, welcome back to Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, I believe we spoke to you when your wildly best-selling book, 30 Million Words, came out, and that was all about sort of the number of words, using words, boosting our children's vocabulary and therefore their cognitive abilities. I think as parents and caregivers in general, we know this, but maybe we don't know what the neuroscience is, what's really scientifically going on in the brain those first 3 years. Can you talk about that to set the stage?
Absolutely. You know, many people don't realize that those first 3 years of life, the foundation for all thinking and learning is being laid, that 85% of the physical brain will be grown during those first 2 years of life. And that at the end of the day, what's building that brain is nurturing talk and interaction from parents and loving caregivers and protection from toxic stress. So it is the foundation of our civilization, how children's brains are developed.
And so with 30 million words, it was sort of about how parents could look at their child individually. But now with Parent Nation, you are talking about an entire society, how we really need all of our policies and all of the way that anyone who deals with children, our whole society in general, really needs to focus on this.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I've spent my whole career dedicated to helping ensure parents and caregivers understand the powerful brain science so that they can best put it into action as their brain architects. It was the basis of my first book, 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain, which was about the fact that nurturing interaction builds that brain. But in my work as a doctor, as a pediatric surgeon, as a researcher, what I saw was that parents embraced this. I mean, they embraced it enthusiastically, but society put roadblock after roadblock in front of parents. And so I thought, gosh, how can we know all of this about early brain development? But yet our society is basically built in diametric opposition to supporting those brain architects, parents, in that role. So I thought, you know what? The world doesn't need another parenting how-to book, although there's some amazing ones out there. What if we use that neuroscience to imagine what a society looks like that is actually aligned with the healthy development of children and the support of families? So that is how Parent Nation was born.
Dr. Susskind, I like how you sort of take a stab at redefining, right, what we mean when we say the word parent. Parent in your book really means kind of any loving caregiver, correct? And, you know, I think one thing as a parent myself, in reading your book, I was reflecting back to the early days and months with my kids. And to be perfectly honest, I kind of couldn't wait to get them into a daycare setting, in part because I really didn't know what I was doing. And I thought, well, I'm gonna work with some folks who do. And I was very lucky at the time. I worked at a university. There was a university-based daycare option for us. It was actually a research facility, so there were students studying the children, unbeknownst to them, of course, with the caregivers. But, you know, I'd love to hear you talk about sort of some of the ideal models for these daycare settings that you see based on your own neuroscience research, and then maybe, you know, contrast them with maybe what we have as the predominant model here in the U.S.
Yeah, no, I mean, and just to your first point, parenting is hard, right? There is no doubt about it. And I think COVID-19 really shined a light on none of us parent alone, right? I parents are the parents, right? Whether it's, you know, biologic parents or grandparents who are raising children, they're the ones raising the children. But none of us parent alone. And, you know, in our country, with a dearth of societal supports for parents, we've convinced them that it's a go it alone. So when things aren't going well, you feel like, oh, why am I failing? Rather than saying, well, why is society not supporting me? But to your question of what does, you know, when I say the term parent, you know, I really wanted to make it inclusive, you know, while still parents are the parent, that early child care providers can provide that same nurturing interaction. But yet in this country, you know, only 10% of child care settings that when parents go to work, they want to know that their children are in high quality settings with, you know, providers who are being fairly compensated. Only 10% are. There are child care deserts out there. And so really an ideal model is where a place of child, you know, where we respect the child care providers as another part of the brain architect builders, and are fairly compensated so that they can provide calm, nurturing environments and not be stressed, and that we invest in them from day one. Because as we all know, right, learning doesn't start on the first day of school or preschool. It starts on the first day of life, and we need to invest in that way.
You know, we now, you know, you can have a free education beginning in kindergarten, and in many school districts now they're boasting that they have free pre-K. But what you're saying is that really where we should be focusing is on free daycare, or is that correct?
What I'm saying, you know, I think, first of all, the message isn't that the K-12 or pre-K space isn't important. We should be investing in strengthening it, absolutely. But we've made a commitment as a country. We realize that investing in the human capital, in the human development, makes us stronger as a nation and more productive. And I'm saying that we need to invest when learning begins on the first day of life. And it's less, it should be affordable, or affordable childcare, but affordable investing in parents that, mm-hmm. you know, I actually in the book put forth the idea, you know, that people have been talking about in the healthcare space, that the healthcare space can be a powerful entry point into this education system and an anchor that helps support parents in both knowing the brain science, right? Where none of us, we love, you know, innately, we love and want to nurture our children, but that doesn't mean we know the brain science. It's new, right? So we need a way to be able to share this knowledge, as well as support parents in those, you know, tough early years. You know, as mentioned before, you know, it's stressful, and the healthcare space can be the place that we can reach and support parents as well.
And this could also extend into, I mean, notoriously in this country, we have very short maternity and paternity leave, if at all. And I think, you know, our, you know, friends over there in the Western European countries would say, what? You have 6 weeks of maternity leave? That's crazy. So that's another sort of societal shift that I'm sure you would be arguing for.
Absolutely. Let me just clarify. We are literally the only one of 38 developed nations not to have paid family and medical leave. Literally, let that sink in. We are the only ones. And what does that result in? One in four mothers go back to work within 2 weeks of having a child. I mean, if you're lucky, look, employers play a huge role. And if you're lucky enough to be an employer that provides it, great. But the majority of parents don't have that, and they're going back to work. And the, you know, there's a huge obvious economic case for paid parental and family leave and sort of the caregiving lens, as well as, you know, for maternal mental health, fathers are critically important, but there's even new research showing why it's important for healthy brain development. Natalie Brito and her colleagues at NYU showed that mothers who had paid parental leave, as opposed to those without it, their children had sort of stronger early brain development, if you will. It wasn't a randomized control trial, but it was pretty strong evidence that because their hypothesis was that mothers were so stressed, right? They tested the cortisol, the stress hormone in their hair. Those without paid leave had higher stress levels, which probably transmitted to the children and their early brain development. So at every level, these policies and social norms impact parents and they impact children. So yes, we need paid leave. I mean, at the very bare minimum, so.
Well, it's so interesting, right? So this is Cool Science Radio, obviously, a show focused on science. And so talking about the neuroscience and the research that you and your colleagues have done, demonstrating the importance of these first 3 years of life, not only for the child, but like you just said, the stress levels on the parents. And if you invest early in creating those caring, nurturing environments, both for the developing brain of the child and for the parent, the outcomes or your return on your investment, right, if you want to put it more into economic terms, is tremendous. I'm wondering, you give this comparison to what we as a nation have done for folks 65 and older and the creation of AARP and their effectiveness in terms of lobbying policymakers. You suggest that maybe there's a model that we could build on there for investing in, you know, 0 to 3, and from our country's perspective, you know, translating the research that you guys have done into effective policy advocacy. I'm curious to hear, you know, your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I mean, to your point, you know, I'm a translational research scientist. But I always say, if we didn't have one more randomized control trial, if we didn't have one more study, if we didn't have one more economic case, we have so much information showing us that those first years of life are critical, and we know what needs to happen, right? And we've got a huge economic case. I mean, everybody talks about price tags. Because of the return on investment, this is a negative cost, because for every dollar you invest, you get $12 or $13 back. Like, seriously, it's a great investment. And as I've been thinking about the translation of the science and why we don't move forward, what seems so clear is that we don't have the political voice, right? We don't have the voices coming together. Policymakers, legislators don't feel like they need to answer to parents. I mean, certainly, you know, you try to remove Social Security, there, you've got a unified voice of the AARP. And so as I was trying to think about bright spots of a different time, and, you know, half a century ago, the poorest, most underserved segment of society age-wise were the elderly. Today, it's children under five today in our country are the poorest. Like, seriously? Back then, though, it was the elderly. And through unifying their voice with the AARP and the gray lobby, no, you know, in Medicare and Social Security, no age demographic is better cared for. No age demographic has a larger political voice as they should. They had a poverty drop of 70% in the elderly. Before then, it was like 50% were living below the minimum standards of decency. And so in writing this book and talking to parents from all different backgrounds, I mean, seriously, I didn't just talk to families that I work with, from, you know, red and blue and, you know, all educational, racial and ethnic backgrounds, you heard the same stories over and over again. Parents struggling, wanting to do right by their children, wanting to do right by the science that we all know. And I was like, gosh, if we could follow that model of the AARP and bring, you know, these, you know, tens of millions of parents together so that we can push forward this nation and make people listen, maybe that would change things.
Yeah, and it's Congress is currently debating, is it renewal or a family package of legislation right now, renewal of the Comprehensive Child Development Act. And I'm curious, you know, do you and your colleagues work with some of the existing, if not, you know, disparate advocacy groups? Do you feel optimistic about what is going on in Washington right now? Or do you feel that, you know, this might be an opportunity that passes us by?
Well, you know, I always say, you know, COVID-19 is like an if not now, when? I mean, seriously, it feels like, you know, sometimes it feels a little bit stuck because I don't think that, you know, there's so many incredible organizations across the country working in different sort of silos of paid leave, high quality childcare. You know, if we could bring these voices together, I think that would be very effective. I think it's, you know, a little bit of a long game here. We need to have some positive wins. But, you know, I want to emphasize that there's a policy, an important policy play. Absolutely. I mean, we need mandated paid family and medical leave. Absolutely. But I think that in, you know, in this book and in my discussions, there's a role for all of society to play. I think that corporate America, you know, businesses who are sort of the economic engines of our nation and who are suffering too because of the lack of, you know, supports for families. So families are, you know, talent is leaving the workforce or they're losing talent. I think that they can play an important role, not just in helping, I don't want to say fill the stopgaps, but, you know, provide supports for flexibility for families, you know, childcare supports, but they can help push forward these policies too, because this makes great economic sense. I mean, I'm tired of it being framed in a political way. Almost all people in this country are parents, and if they're not, they were definitely children. So, you know, let's remove all this, you know, crazy discussion and start living up to our values of being about children and families.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Dana Suskind. Her new book is Parent Nation, Unlocking Every Child's Potential, Fulfilling Society's Promise. And Dr. Suskind, I am wondering about going back sort of to the individual child and this concept of neuroplasticity between birth and age 3 or maybe age 5, and the strengthening of the good neural networks, and then this concept that you define as pruning, you know, pruning, taking out what you don't want to strengthen so that the what you want to strengthen becomes even stronger. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. You know, in truth, those first 3 years of life, I like to sort of put forward as the universe's evolutionary gift, right? The whole reason that humans are the smartest of all species is those first 3 years of life. When we're born, our brains come out pretty underdeveloped. Because if you wanted the brain to be as big as it needed to be as smart as, we wouldn't fit through our mother's birth canal. And as any mother, we don't want the head any bigger. So the universe made a trade-off. It said, okay, then those first 3 years of life is when I'm going to build these 85% of the physical brain. But at the same time, it relies on an instruction guide from the environment of what connections are important. So if you're born, so I never want to frame it as good versus bad. It's really adaptive to what the environment is telling it. So when you are born into an environment that gives lots of rich language, that nurturing interaction, the three T's that I talk about in my first book, you're wiring up the brain to help build big vocabulary and literacy and, you know, all of those important things that are important for school. If you're born into sort of an environment with huge amounts of toxic stress that's really unstable, the brain wires up in reaction to that, right? Expecting, you know, violence or difficult times, and it wires it in a certain way. So we as a society have set up our society in that you need a good job, you need an education to be successful. So you need those early years to be wiring up those things that are going to help make a child successful in school and socio-emotional development. So that was a long-winded way to say that we need to provide parents the calm environment and the time and bandwidth to provide the nurturing interaction that will help them succeed in school and life. Was that too long-winded?
No,
sorry.
That makes sense, but it makes me wonder also about, you know, you have been very focused on language and the concept of 30 million words, and it's not just the volume of language and of words. It's not sitting, obviously, your child down in front of the TV, because then they'll hear words, but that's better probably than the absence of words at all. But it's about that interplay, and it's funny, it goes back to we were talking in the green room before about, you know, this little piggy went to the market. This little piggy stayed home. Literally, you know, eye contact with the child, you know, physical contact at the same time you're providing this context of language that's meaningful. And yeah, what does the new science, the new research, you know, tell us about it, you know, improving upon what we've been doing?
Absolutely. So just as you say, at the end of the day, to build a healthy brain, in our center, we've cored it down to what we've boiled down the science to what we call the three T's: tuning into your child, using eye contact, getting on their level, talking about it, using rich language, talking about the past, the future, and the present, and taking turns, really seeing your child as a conversational partner from day one. So even though I called my book 30 million words because it was based on that study, really at the end of the day, it's that nurturing interaction. And the studies that the new sort of neuroscience studies that we're seeing really strengthen this idea. Some really cool brainwave studies done at Princeton have shown that by doing this, really you're getting your brain waves are synchronizing between a, you know, parent and child. So it's at the deepest level that these connections are being made and helping strengthening the brain. So and I can go on about the science, but yeah, so it's pretty cool.
No, and I think that's something that as we sort of, you know, see this next generation growing up, obviously the inputs that they're receiving are so different than what we had as children. I mean, we didn't have screens, we didn't have mobile phones. I absolutely feel for the parent who feels the need to, you know, give their kid the mobile phone to take a look at to keep them distracted when they're at a restaurant or anything like that. But I think it, you know, we inherently and instinctively, we know it goes back to that quality human interaction. And, you know, we just have a few minutes left. I'm curious if you could leave our listeners with, you know, one big takeaway or, you know, an action that they can take, whether with their own children or with the children that they interact with through our community here or from an advocacy side of things. You know, what would you want listeners to take away from today's discussion?
Absolutely. First of all, Parent Nation is, I want it's a love letter to parents, right? I want parents, number one, to give themselves grace. Raising children is not easy. And to know that good enough parenting really is a thing. We've all, and to elevate their expectations, start expecting society to better support you because you are building, you're the guardians of our country's future. And I want you to see yourself that way. And I want you to look around, look at other parents, see yourselves as allies and start demanding more from your employer, from your policymakers. Go to parentnation.org where we have free downloadable resources to really put this into action because you deserve more and what you're doing is so important.
And just to finish that thought off, you know, we live in a town where we have an aging population, a lot of people who want to volunteer and give back to their community, to society in general. And I have a feeling I know what you would say, what that thing is to do. You know, what is it?
It takes all of us. Yeah. And I mean, I love grandparents. I think grandparents not only can support their own children, but can support all children and families. So I think that really taking that model and coming together to, you know, build a parent nation is what we need to do.
Parent Nation, unlocking every child's potential, fulfilling society's promise. Our guest is Dr. Dana Suskind. Dana, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow, what an important book.
Oh, I know.
Really important. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Thanks to my guest co-host, Sarah Irvin. John Wells will be back in a few weeks. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.